So let's do it anyway. Let's go. All right, ready?
We have seven.
Okay. House Committee on Revenue for April 9th, 2015 will come to order. Thank you all for coming today. We're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3481 from yesterday, the bill having to do with the harvesting of timber. And we have some august members here to speak with us. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley. I represent South Jackson County in the legislature. I serve as the House co-chair on the Joint Committee of Ways and Means. And it's the second role there that drives me to your committee to testify on behalf of this bill. My apologies for not being available yesterday when you first heard the bill. I'd like to thank Representative Holvey for bringing this bill forward. And my message to the committee is very simple and to anybody who is involved with timber issues in the state of Oregon. I believe this bill is a very creative approach to trying to address issues that we have in our state. I fully support the idea of a tax credit for logs that are milled in the state of Oregon and jobs that helps keep in the state of Oregon. But more importantly, Mr. Chair and members, as you all well know, the last two fire seasons in our state have been catastrophes for us. Our cost above our insurance policy that we have had for recent years reach into the tens of millions of dollars. It's a direct impact on our general fund, direct impact on our ability to fund schools, to fund services for seniors and people with disabilities, to fund public safety, tens of millions of dollars in the fire costs that we're incurring. The fire seasons have been so disastrous for our state that our long-standing insurance policy with Lloyd's of London is no longer viable for Lloyd's of London to offer us. Currently, the current proposal would be an increase in the premium, almost doubling the premium, but the coverage would have a $50 million deductible. A $50 million deductible. I think as a state, we have to be willing to look at every possible idea to the benefit of all concerned that might help address the crisis that we are facing in trying to protect our forests through the fire seasons to come. Again, I find myself this session waving a lot of red flags, and this is a red flag I feel I need to wave to the legislature and to ask for the help of the legislature, of the committee, the revenue committee, ask the help of the timber industry, ask the help of all of us to figure out solutions. And again, Representative Holvey has brought forward an idea. Yeah, and the idea is, I think, worth consideration, worth adjusting how, at what level a severance tax might be levied, and where the expenditures would go. And of course, I'm here to lobby as hard as I can that I believe expenditures of any potential severance tax should go into the Fire Protection Fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Madam Speaker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. I'm here to support and echo the testimony we just heard from Representative Peter Buckley, our co-chair of Ways and Means. I learned this morning about the proposed increased cost of premium for our Lloyd's of London insurance policy that provides a very critical backstop for the state to cover our fire protection costs. Our current premium is $20 million. The proposal is $50. We have a $30 million gap to maintain that policy, and we must maintain that policy. And I agree with my good colleague here that the severance tax proposal is a creative way. It could be redirected. It could be amended to go to fire protection costs. And I urge all the stakeholders involved with this issue to look at that as an option because we need something. And thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. I think this is really important, and I'm glad that you're here in support. I have a question about the numbers that you just cited, whomever is the appropriate person to respond. Our deductible is going to be $50 million up from $20 million. Is that right?
Correct.
Deductible, yes.
Ms. Chair and Langer, yes, the way the system, the insurance policy has worked up to now, we've shared costs between the state and private landowners up to $20 million. The insurance policy has covered 20 to 50, and then we've carried the cost above that. The current proposal from Lloyd's is that there would be a $50 million deductible before their coverage would kick in. Given the cost of fires in recent summers, it's likely that they would be kicking in at some point, but we would have to cover that additional $30 million.
May I ask a follow-up?
Please, yes.
And I've been reading different numbers about what we spent in general fund dollars on fire protection efforts, say last year. Do either of you happen to know roughly what that number was last year?
Mr. Representative, I do know in the 2013 fire season, it was approximately $40 million of general fund dollars went to backfill the cost in fires. I don't have in my memory the 2014 number.
Thank you.
It wasn't as bad, but it certainly wasn't swell.
Okay. Right.
And thank you for the clarified question.
Other questions? I think it would be useful to have that number, and it's my understanding, and I don't know what information you're getting at this point, that the forests are drier this year than they've been in recent years. I'm getting a head nod from Commissioner Freeman about that. The likelihood, I am assuming, is that the total cost of fighting fires is going to be higher in the next biennium than what we faced in the last one.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's exactly why I'm waving the red flag. I live in Southern Oregon. Many counties of the state are already listed as drought areas. Jackson County is not yet. But the fire seasons we've lived through the last 2 years have been beyond anything I'd experienced before. And it's a constant fear in our minds of what's going to happen with fires in our region throughout the state. And we've experienced some, as you know, some tremendously large and destructive fires. And the forecast for this coming summer frightens the heck out of me.
Thank you. It's also my understanding that firefighting costs are divided up in the way you suggest. Also, the federal government participates in helping fight fires because these lands are all contiguous with each other, and the fire doesn't know where the boundary lines are, does it?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. And Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your attention to this really important situation. Can you share with us how much came from the general fund last year or this biennium?
I'll have to get that number for you. Again, the 2013 number sticks in my head as $40 million, but the 2014 fire season number was somewhere, I'm riffing here, Representative, but I think it was around $28 million. I'll have to double-check and get that to you.
Yes, please. Uh-huh.
And I guess the issue is, in looking at this particular proposed funding mm-hmm. mechanism, how much would you anticipate you would need from this to balance, equal, achieve, whatever the goal is? I'm trying to figure out
sure.
how much is going to come from the general fund in your thoughts and how much you want from a device like this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, I think that's all flexible. Right now, as I understand how the bill works, there are several divisions of $3 each of the proposed $20 tax would go to different areas that Representative Holvey has identified. Representative Holvey, I think in his testimony yesterday, said he's totally willing to be flexible both on the $20 number and on the distribution of those $3 pieces. We would have to, I think, sit down, work out with industry, and work out, obviously, with the rest of the members of Ways and Means, what percentage of the severance tax would go to complete what we feel would be a safe enough fund to carry us through a particularly disastrous fire season. To clarify, the emergency board, the e-board, was created because of fire season costs. Right now in our framework, we have $30 million slated to go into the e-board to cover fire costs and other costs. That's for a two-year period.
Please. Yeah.
So if it was this body's decision to impose a tax adequate to fund the fire only, that would be of interest, that kind of a number. But in that regard, also, there was some work done by Senator Wyden reallocating proceeds from Federal Forest Service monies mm-hmm. that was designed to add significantly to these funds.
That's correct.
That would have to be taken into account. Has that been taken into account?
Mr. Chair, Representative, not yet, because I don't believe it's final yet from the federal government side, but that would have to be taken into account.
Yeah.
Final question. I'm not sure we heard, if we did, I've forgotten, how much is already being put up by such companies as Weyerhaeuser and others to fight fire. Do we know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, if my memory serves, and I'm sure others in this room will correct me if I'm wrong, we split the first $20 million. So $10 million is put up by private property owners.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. For the witnesses on this bill, we are going to close this public hearing now, but we will reopen in a few minutes after we have heard from members who want to speak on House Bill 2070. With that, we'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2070, and we'll hear from members who want to speak on that bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44 in North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2070. You should see a -1 amendment in OLIS. The -1 would completely replace House Bill 2070, so I just say look at that. That is the proposal that I want to speak to you today. So the topic of the day is gainshare. Many of you know that's the revenue sharing program that we created in 2007 at the request of Washington County to help mitigate some of the costs of strategic investment program agreements that were entered into. You know, that's a very important local economic development tool. I won't go into details of SIPs, but this bill and this proposal has nothing to do with SIPs. I'm not talking about the statutes around that program. That tool has a lot of merit. It's been in place prior to gainshare, came into being in 1993. So I just want to be clear that I'm here today to talk about gainshare. So, colleagues, I think it's time for us to revamp gainshare. I was here in 2007 when we passed the bill. I was a freshman at the time, and I recall a proposal to help out those counties who have entered into SIP agreements to help them with some of their infrastructure needs that would come about by having more employees because of recruiting and bigger employers in the high-tech world. And because of gainshare, at the time, in 2007, it was basically, let's help the counties out a little bit who have entered into these agreements. I didn't give any thought to the mechanism at the time. I'd be lying if I said I remembered that. I don't. But I did vote for the bill. And because I believed in the underlying intent. Back then, the revenue impact estimate was anticipated to be $600,000 for 2009-11 and $4.5 million for 2011-13. But we need a reset, colleagues. We didn't get it right. We, in fact, got it wrong in 2007. First of all, we allowed the computation of income tax to include jobs that were already there when the SIP agreements were approved. Because of this, the payments to counties in the 13-15 biennium ballooned to $62 million. Now for the 15-17 biennium, gainshare payments are expected to be nearly $95 million. The second thing we didn't get right is we miscalculated the impact that this revenue sharing with particular counties would have on the rest of the state. Since the state's general fund is the prime funding source for education, human services, and public safety in all 36 counties, we didn't adequately take into account how this generosity would impact those counties and how it would take away from essential services from around the state, whether our schools, our programs for seniors, our community colleges, you name it, we fund those things. Our generosity has impacted the entire state. So it's time for a reset. So in the -1 amendment that you have before you, it does several things. First of all, it redefines the base that is used for the calculation of the income tax revenue and says it should be only newly created jobs. Part of our problem is we had all jobs prior to the SIP agreements, prior to gainshare, and so the underlying base number was quite large. We need to reset that for newly created jobs only. because of our responsibility to the rest of the state, I also think we should cap the amount of payments that can go out to the taxing districts who enter into SIP agreements. And that is about straight out sustainability for the state. So this amendment says the maximum amount that a taxing district could get in a biennium is $10 million. Because this program is being restructured significantly, I would say I would support extending the sunset with this new framework to 2025, thereby giving certainty to those counties that some support would come in, and this is what it would be through 2025. And because not all of the money that would come into the shared services fund from the allocation from the income tax revenue would be spent, I drafted into the amendment that any remaining money, any surplus, would go into the state school fund. Now, that could be changed. That could be the rainy day fund. That could be the emergency fund. You know, that could be something else. I just didn't want any leftover money being sitting in the shared services fund coming from the gain share allocation. So with these changes, instead of sending nearly $95 million to SIP districts next biennium, 94.2 of that going to Washington County alone, Gainshare would pay out a more sustainable $10.7 million to SIP districts, with $10 million maximum going to Washington County. And then a leftover amount of almost $8 million would go into the state school fund under the Dash 1 Amendment. And these changes would also direct almost $58 million back to the general fund for allocation through the regular budget process. So last week, the Senate committee passed out Senate Bill 129A to the Ways and Means Committee, and that bill took a fundamentally different approach to addressing the challenges of Gainshare. It's essentially a spending plan on how to allocate the money differently, and really the only fundamental change in that proposal is extending the sunset and modifying the sunset, if you really look at the underlying core mechanics of Gainshare. And while I personally support sending money to OSU extension programs or career and technical education programs or more money to the state school fund, Senate Bill 129 does not solve the underlying problems with Gainshare, doesn't solve the underlying flaws, the unfairness and unsustainability of that program. We should do something to support the counties who've entered into SIP agreements to promote economic development. There are some issues there, I get that, but this is about balance between what we can do and what we are able to do in terms of helping these counties who have also benefited from these SIP agreements, because these companies still pay property taxes, just not as much as they would under these agreements. They are getting the direct benefit from that economic development, and we should do something, but we have to do something that is reasonable and sustainable. Colleagues, we need to reinvest in our entire state, our schools, quality and accessible childcare, our universities, our community colleges, programs for seniors and people with disabilities, mental health services, local courts, all kinds of critical services for Oregonians around the state. Adjusting the formula to reform Gainshare is one step we can make on the larger effort to make sure all these crucial investments can be made. So I encourage you to amend House Bill 2070 with the Dash 1 and pass it on to Ways and Means for further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be back in Hearing Room A. I miss you all. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is West Portland and Tigard. I'm here to support the Dash 1 amendment, and I want to thank the speaker for her time and attention to this. I think she's come up with a very reasonable proposal. And it actually mirrors what I thought I was voting on in 2007, when not only was I a member of the legislature, whose district includes Washington County, by the way, I was a member of the committee, and my name was on the bill. So you can't get much more culpable than me as to what's happened. I'm the first one to say, to admit that we made a mistake. And I really commend the speaker for coming up with a good approach to fairly compensate Washington County for the tremendous contribution they've made to our economic well-being in the state. When we, in my defense, in 2007, we did not have the Intel report in front of us. In 2012, Intel commissioned a study from Eco Northwest to analyze the economic impact of the company on Washington County. And the results were stunning. Intel, with the SIP reductions in place, is the largest taxpayer in the state of Oregon. And of those, the largest property taxpayer in the state of Oregon, probably income tax too, but this is about property tax. Intel contributes direct and indirect and induced property tax revenues of $106 million per year in Washington County. There are some other counties that benefit by maybe $30 million a year around the state, but the bulk of the economic, direct economic impact is in Washington County. The SIP program has been amazingly successful. And I might say for the record also that the SIP program was enacted with strong support from Washington County because they knew it would be an economic engine for them. They have implemented it very well. They have attracted one of the finest companies in the world who has made Washington County a source of pride for the entire state. Intel employs 16,500 workers, 12,000 of whom live in Washington County. And the estimated income of these workers is over $2 billion and serves as an economic driver for the local business community. According to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics report dated February 2015, Washington County's unemployment is at a very low 4.9%. These numbers are in stark contrast to many other counties in the state. Currently, 11 Oregon counties have an unemployment rate over 8%, with five of those counties having an unemployment rate above 10%. Given how well Washington County is doing, in large part because of their relationship with Intel, while much of the state is struggling, I would wager that many of the other counties would sign an SIP agreement with or without any kind of gain share compensation. As we approached this issue and tried to reform the program, I would ask the committee to, there are several bills, including my bill. I actually like the speaker's bill better than my own bill. But as we consider those, I would ask you to consider three principles. One is to limit gain share in any context to net new jobs only, because that's what I thought I was voting for in 2007, and I thought that was fair. Secondly, I would ask the committee to keep schools harmless in any allocation of gain share revenue. Schools are not at the table when SIPs are signed. They are not at the table when gain share formulas are being realized, and schools need to be held harmless from any benefits that go to gain share counties. And the third thing is I would really want to make sure that the committee makes whatever sunset you put in, whether retaining the existing sunset or moving the sunset, that you make it a hard sunset. The bill that my colleague mentioned, the other Senate bill that's in Ways and Means right now, has a soft sunset. What that means is any gain share formula that is in effect when the program sunsets would continue to allocate money beyond the sunset until the SIP has expired. This is critical. Recently, Washington County signed a new SIP with Genentech, and earlier last year, they signed a major, trying to look for the actual information here. They signed a major SIP with Washington County for, I believe it's $30 billion, I'm having trouble finding it, that will go into effect over the next, I think it's $3 billion, over the next 30 years. And it'll probably be in three or more phases. And so you have all this unknown impact that if you don't structure the gain share program correctly, we could end up with another unanticipated revenue impact. I think it's kind of ironic that we did the gain share bill in the same session that we did the Betsy expansion, and I see similarities between the two mistakes. So I will just leave it at that and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul, we skipped the introduction. I think they explained the bill pretty well. Do you think so? All right. Members, would you like? I have questions for our panel here. Simply a remark. You could have gone all day without mentioning Betsy. I remember that way too well. Thank you very much. And
we spent many an hour in a windowless room fixing that one.
Fixing that one. Yes, we did.
Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you. For those who are here to testify, I want to let you know that we're going to go back now to House Bill 3481. The people who are here for that bill sat through all day yesterday and still didn't get to testify. And then we will be back to 2070. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2070 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3481. And I have a new list, and I noticed that Ralph is now acknowledges that he's across the street. And with that, we'll start with I'm just going to go down the list. Ralph Saberstein, Matt Evans, and Link Cannon to start.
He's on the other.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get him first because he's more than 100 miles away.
Yeah.
You guys want me to start?
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
I'll start then. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lincoln Cannon. I represent the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm the Director of Forest Resources and Taxation. I was having sat through yesterday, it was interesting how the tenor of the conversation has changed from yesterday to today. Yesterday, this was a my testimony is online, and it addresses the multiple pieces of this bill. What we heard today is all about fire funding. And so with that, I'd like to make some remarks specific to that before I get into my written testimony.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
I'm not an expert in fire funding. It's a hugely complicated system. So these are my observations, and I would suggest if you want to get into this in depth, the Department of Forestry or Mike Dykstra with our organization would be able to provide you with good information. Oregon has a unique public-private partnership sharing responsibility for funding forest fire prevention and suppression. In contrast, most states, including Washington and California, firefighting costs are general funded. In fact, in this shared model, which is been referred to conceptually as the 50-50 funding model, state-private. Since 1992, private landowners in the state have paid 67% of the costs of fire suppression already. We pay through the forest products harvest tax, we pay on property tax bills, so we pay quite a bit. And in addition to that, private landowners lose their resources when they have wildfires that are not reimbursable by anyone. So we're very interested in fire. We have a great system in this state where the state and private entities cooperate very closely to minimize the risk of fires. Mm-hmm. As to federal forest lands, there are over 60% of the forest land in the state, and most of them are in eastern and southern Oregon. Of those lands, over two-thirds are at moderate or severe risk of wildfire due to a lack of management since the 1980s. They're overgrown, they're tinder boxes, and as the chair noted, fires do not recognize property boundaries. So we continue to be concerned and hope that the legislature will look at solutions for helping resolve that problem. I know the governor has money for the forest cooperatives in eastern Oregon to help reduce fire risk. But we pay a lot already, and the idea that we should pay more is pretty questionable to us. With that, to get back to the other pieces of the bill, on page one of my testimony, you already know what the bill does. I've turned that into a dollar figure. At the bottom of the page, a $20 per board foot tax equates to roughly an $80 to $100 per log truck load tax. In other words, you get 400,000 to 500,000 board feet on a truck. Of that, $6 would go for administration out of $100. I did 100 instead of 80 because the math's easier. $6 would go for administration. $60 would go to fund various state programs, fire funding, the biomass tax credit, the watershed thing, and the wood stove program. $13 would be rebated back to credits for logs processed in state. And this particular piece is very problematic just in terms of administration, and I'll talk about that a little more. And then the remainder, $20, is distributed back to counties. If you assume an average annual harvest of 4 billion board feet, that equates to an $80 million new tax on our industry. So first I'd talk about how timber is taxed now briefly, because it has some implications for the county piece, I think. Oregon forest land owners are already taxed like other real properties in the state, subject to measures 55 and 50, the constitutional property tax limitations. Forest land owners pay the tax based on the value of their property. Some people say we get a tax break because we are specially assessed. I'd be happy to talk about that more. I'm sure you don't want to hear about it now, but in fact, for large landowners, there is not a special assessment. The specially assessed values are essentially the market values of those lands in forest use. In addition to that, we harvest timber, and the legislature determined over 25 years ago that modern forest management is producing a crop. We're not harvesting old growth anymore, and they determined that a severance tax was in. We don't levy severance taxes on apples or pears or peaches or hazelnuts, whatever, and they determined that timber was a crop and they should not levy a severance tax on that. So we pay property taxes on our land, and we pay income taxes and property taxes on the harvest and utilization of the crop. The tax credit for in-state processing is kind of a residual from, I think, the previous versions of this bill in past sessions. And it was this was really targeted at reducing or trying to incentivize domestic production of logs as opposed to exporting logs. It's greatly reduced here. It's $3. Now it was the entire tax credit in the last iterations of this. But as to the export piece, there's substantial economic research, and we'd be happy to provide as much as the committee would like, that restrictions on log exports and are inefficient and damaging to industry. They disrupt the market in ways that when markets change, the results are not positive. Further, export logs, particularly in the last downturn during the recession, exports, domestic markets, mills weren't looking for logs. There was the housing market was down. There were not demand for products, and the export market actually kept jobs that would otherwise have been lost in trucking, logging, longshoring, shipping. So it was a benefit. Log exports were a large benefit to the economy during that time period. As our markets recover, domestic markets can competitively bid with offshore buyers for logs, and we see that coming back. The market is working as it should. In one particular case, and this export penalty, if you will, would not only apply to logs overseas, but it would apply to logs that go to other states. In other words, if it's cut in Oregon, it has to be processed in Oregon in order to get the tax rebate. We have landowners in northwestern Oregon who routinely shipped to Longview or across the river to Washington producers, and Washington logs come from Washington to Oregon, and similarly, although not nearly as dramatically, on the California border. So taxing those log flows would be a problem. You know, it would not solve, I think, what this concept is trying to do, which is address the international exports. It wouldn't solve that, and it would just impose an unnecessary penalty on those landowners. So as to the, I guess, the rest of the bill, I would say the administration of this export piece or tax rebate piece in particular is very problematic. ODF, I think, may think they could figure out how to do it. But I'll give you an example of why it would be problematic. I'm a landowner. I cut my logs. I put them on a truck. I take them to a sort yard where they're merchandised. Some logs go export. Some logs go domestic. Some logs go to different mills based on the highest value you can get for those logs. You have a landowner over here that does the same thing, so you end up with truckloads of logs going out of the sort yard to an export market, to a domestic market. In order to track where those logs came from, you'd almost have to barcode each one of them, because you have a truckload of logs that arrives at the export port with that came from four different landowners, and it was some percentage of that harvest. So from that perspective, it would be very difficult to do. And I think that's, you get the point on that. The other pieces are just, you know, I think Representative Holvey said that these are to fund activities, the $3 for all of these other things, to fund activities that are of interest to the forest products industry or related to the forest products industry. I would note the biomass tax credit piece of it, which will actually be up in the next session with the House Energy and Environment Committee, is 75% now utilized by manure for anaerobic digestion. So why forest landowners should pay for that program, you know, as it stands today is pretty questionable. I think similarly for the watershed grant, we already do substantial voluntary work through OWEB and watershed restoration, and I'm not sure why we should pay more for that, and so on. So I think that's enough, Mr. Chair, and I'll stop there. And if you have questions, I'm open.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ralph Saperstein, and for listening to me, even though I just crossed the street, I appreciate that. As my daughter reminds me all the time, I'm just learning. Like Link, because of the sponsor and the other illustrious members that were here talking about this bill, it kind of changes the focus of what I wanted to talk about. I'm representing Associated Oregon Loggers, Logger AOL. It's a statewide trade group with nearly 1,000 logging and allied forest contract companies. These are small family-owned companies in rural Oregon. The issue of that creating a privilege tax isn't the answer. The problem is not we aren't taxed enough. The problem is a raw material supply. And our federal lands, as Link has mentioned, are in very poor health. And the other thing I will say, he's talked about log yards and exports. We cannot export logs from public forest lands, whether state or federal. So log exports aren't an issue on federal lands. And it's the federal lands that have reduced their timber supply by 90% since the 90s. So that's the best way to solve this timber supply crisis for loggers and rural communities, is to get the federal forests to be managed in, to increase forest health and reduce the risk of wildfire. The fires that we have to raise money to fight, they aren't generated on private forest land. They're generated generally on federal forest land, and they spread to private forest land. So there's two reasons, you know, to get the federal government to take care of their forest lands. The first is timber supply, but also to reduce our fire costs. And we have, as Link described, a long-standing process for dealing with forest fires and shared responsibility. But loggers feel very strongly that restricting the trade of logs is not the answer. If you remember during the Great recession, when the housing market crashed, many of our members stayed alive only through logging for the export market, because if you're going to export logs, you still need loggers to thaw them, to yard them, to truck them. So that was really key, of key importance for us, was to maintain the log export market. So I just like to summarize by saying the problem isn't going to be addressed by creating a new harvest tax and getting a $3 tax credit if you manufacture domestically. The problem is on our federal and state, to a little extent, federal timber supply from these government-owned lands. And log exports aren't involved in that issue. It's just like barcoding. You have to brand every log that's cut, and that's why when they do inspections at log yards, as Link described, they can tell which loggers are public logs or private logs. So that's not the issue. There's no tomfoolery in this. But the timber supply issue is very, very critical for our rural communities, employment, and the fire issue. Because if the federal forests were managed as most of us learn how to do in college, we wouldn't be having this fire issue. Remember, the fires aren't starting on private forest lands, which are very well managed. The fires are starting on federal lands with poor forest management. Mm-hmm. I'd entertain any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm a resident of Raleigh Hills, and I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. My friends from industry have done a good job of talking about the impacts that a bill like this will have on them and their families and their employees. I want to take a more philosophical whack at this if I could. This is the sort of bill, and again, we've heard a little bit of change of tone and tenor, but this is the sort of bill that's difficult to justify. I'm sure everyone on the committee has a laundry list of wonderfully beneficial programs that they'd love to see either funded for the first time or have its funding increased, and figuring out a way to make that happen can be difficult when there are so many things happening in a session. It's one thing to have a user fee that you can tie directly into a benefit to the users paying the fee. It's quite another thing to have a user fee that's sort of generally distributed to whoever's laundry list happens to be on top right now. I thought Representative Holvey and Representative Buckley and the Speaker did a great job, a passionate job of talking about the problems that we have with regard to firefighting and the cost increase that they're looking at. I think you might be hard-pressed, however, to go to taxpaying families in this state and say, well, we've got $18 billion to spend and we can't find $30 million in order to take care of fire suppression needs. Most families would look at those two amounts and say, well, if this is a priority for you, you should be able to set firefighting and fire suppression as a priority and find that money someplace else in the budget. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Warm out.
Mr. Chair, one other observation. Greg Miller was here with Weyerhaeuser all day yesterday,
waiting to testify, and we didn't get up.
So he sends his apologies. He was unable to attend today. And also former Representative Chuck Burley with Interfor, and Adrian Miller with who's Adrian with?
Used to be
Longview Fiber. Yeah, Olympic Forest Resources lands also were unable to attend, but both support my testimony on this bill. Thank you.
Would you extend my apologies to them that we simply ran out of time?
I understand, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony today. Jenny Dressler, Roger Beyer, please.
Perfect. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregon Farm Bureau is the state's largest general agriculture association with the primary goal of promoting education, economic opportunity, and social advancement for farmers, ranchers, and the natural resources community as a whole. We have a lot of small woodland owners who have diversified operations and are here today to join other natural resources groups in opposition to House Bill 3481. Oregon farmers grow timber as part of their operations and are not taxed on other crops that they grow on their land. Timber was long ago recognized as a crop, and we believe it should be treated like other crops. We see no justification for a punitive tax on farmers who choose to grow trees. We are also concerned that a tax of $80 to $100 per truckload would discourage farmers and small woodland owners from growing trees, and that it would actually incentivize the conversion of their land to other uses. I guess as a final point, there was some discussion yesterday about equity, and Oregon Farm Bureau sees at least the tax that's established in House Bill 3481 as unfairly impacting family farmers and small woodland owners who do operate on tight margins and cannot absorb this significant tax increase. So thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. You have now a testimony from Jim James, the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, who was also here yesterday and was unable to return today. So I have submitted his written testimony for you. I'll just make a couple of points on that. Many family forest land owners have invested in forest land as their retirement or their college savings or for other savings matters. Tax like this, which could be $100 a load, would be approximately that much, or could be as much as $1,000 per acre. The landowners are counting on that money now in order to fund what they've invested for their future, and this would just directly be a tax on that. So with that, you have his written testimony. I'm not going to read it to you. I'm just going to make that point that also remind you that for private forest land, family owners are about 42% of the private forest land owners in the state. I would like to address some of the things I've heard now earlier today and then yesterday on the testimony in this bill. Mr. Cannon made some comments on the fire funding program. I'd like to also add some of that. Currently, Oregon does have a unique system for funding forest fire and how we pay for that. And you heard about, Mr. Cannon said that landowners have paid about 66% of the costs since 1992. That's only the large fire cost. So that's when a fire gets bigger than what the local fire districts can handle. Oregon landowners also pay 50% of the cost to fund the local fire districts in the Department of Forestry, and that is about $45 million a year. And landowners and the general fund of Oregon share half that cost annually. So while as the 66% of the large fire cost, that's when those local districts cannot control the fire anymore, we're still paying almost two-thirds of that cost in addition to the 50% we're paying for just to have the local fire department in place ready to go after those fires when they start. Again, this is a one-of-a-kind system in the U.S. Most other states, if not all other states, this program is completely funded by the taxpayers and general fund. I also like to point out the insurance that you heard from Representative Buckley and the speaker talked about the cost of insurance. It is important to note that insurance is there to protect the general fund. Remember, our assets are at risk, and when our assets burn, our landowners get none of those insurance dollars. We have to completely fund the losses, and we also have to fund the reforestation costs for when our assets burn up. We have to put it back into forest land. We are mandated by state law, both land use laws and the Forest Practices Act, to use these lands for the growing and harvesting of trees. We don't have a choice. We cannot pick up our assets and move them somewhere else. If we could, we may, but we don't have that choice. So if you're looking for money from industries to fund important services, remember, some industries have no choice but to do that. The laws of the state mandate their use for that. As to the effect of milling in Oregon, we all want more mills in Oregon, Believe me, Representative Bence's district would love to have some mills back in Representative Witsit's district, but there are no logs exported from Representative Witsit's district or Representative Bence's district. If log exports was the problem to jobs in the forest economy, they should be booming in the eastern and southern parts of the state because there are no logs exported from those areas of the state. Clearly, it is not a log export problem that has caused that. And finally, I'd like to address some of the issues you heard yesterday about the taxation of forest land and small owners versus large landowners in forest land taxation. In 1999, the speaker was correct. A bill was passed in 1999 that changed the taxation of forest land. I know a little bit about that. I was sitting in the committees, and I was one of the negotiators of that bill at that time. Landowners between 10 and 5,000 acres requested of the legislature an option to have a severance tax in lieu of property tax. The legislature granted those small landowners that option. Landowners have to opt into that option, and once they opt into it, they cannot opt back out. It is a not widely used program because most landowners, even in that size range, choose to pay the annual property tax instead of doing it at harvest via a severance tax. Remember, the severance tax is in lieu of property taxes. All landowners, regardless of size, pay the property taxes on their forest land. There are no exemptions for large or small landowners on that issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Thanks, Roger, for your testimony. Could you touch on something I think I heard you say regarding the percentage of lands, private lands, that are in owned by small forest lands versus, let's say, larger private owners? I think you said something like 42%. Did I get that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes. In the letter from Jim James, it is about 42% of the private forests are owned by small woodland owners.
Okay. And then as I read the bill, there's no delineation in here regarding how large of forest land that you own. You would pay the same severance tax, i.e. somebody that might have 5 million acres of forest or somebody that might only have 5 or 10 or, a couple of hundred acres would pay that same severance tax on every log that comes off of that property, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, thank you. The way I read the bill, you are correct. There is no exemptions for small landowners under current law with the current harvest tax, which all landowners pay. The harvest tax currently of $3.51, I believe it is, used for various things, one of which is funding fire. There is a 25,000 board foot exemption. For the first 25,000 board feet that each landowner cuts in a year, they do not have to pay the harvest tax on that. That is for large and small landowners across the board. So it's not just my members who get that 25,000 board foot exemption. It's all landowners get that. Their first 25,000 board feet is not taxed. This bill does not have that provision in it.
Please. Yeah. I guess I bring that up or just want to emphasize that point because I think a couple of proponents we heard yesterday believe that they would be that this tax would be more focused on the multi-state or even the multinational type of corporations. And what you're saying is almost half of these private owners certainly wouldn't fit into that category at all. So we're talking about Oregon landowners and Oregon timber harvesting companies who would be shouldering the vast majority of this. If you take the Weyerhaeusers and the Georgia Pacifics out, these are primarily Oregon-owned, Oregon-managed forests that would be paying this tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. You're correct, but this is paid on the harvest, mm-hmm. So it depends right. on which person is harvesting any given year. And recognize these are generational harvests. Many of our family farm forest land owners are harvesting trees that are 60 or 80 years old or even older than that. So, yes, it's a once-in-a-lifetime harvest.
Yep.
But it is directly impacting the ability of that landowner to reforest his property then keep it in a productive forest land if you have to pay more to pay tax.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Representative Bence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this issue is coming up in my part of the country because of the increased fee charges being imposed on the landowners because of needing more money. ODF needs more money for fighting fires. Many of the constituents have called and said, we don't want to pay more, and we blame the Forest Service for its bad management practices for the out-of-control wildfires that we don't dare put firefighters in front of because they're going to get killed. So they wait for them to burn down to a point where they can go put what's left out. And so there's a huge element of blame, if you will, or it should be the U.S. Forest that's liable for these fires because of the reasons I've just stated. On the other hand, and perhaps Senator Wyden is going to do something about getting some funding from the Forest to help that. On the other hand, there's the matter of self-defense and realizing that if we don't do something, if we're waiting for the federal government, we may be all burned up by that time. So my question to you guys would be, what's the proper response? Because certainly we don't want anybody paying any more tax. I mean, already paying quite a bit over there, and I hear a lot about that and how unfair it is. So that appears to me to be the summarization of the problem from my standpoint. Do you have solutions, ideas? Because this is a big problem. It's going to get bigger. This is, I agree completely with the co-chair and the speaker in saying this is a situation that's approaching this summer. Lord knows if this bill would do any good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz. As I already stated, Oregon has a one-of-a-kind, complete and coordinated fire system to protect our forest land from fire, which is paid already half by landowners, half by the general fund. That's the fire department level. The large fire costs are in addition to those, and over which the last 23 years, landowners have paid 66% of those costs. In addition to that, just two years ago now, the formulation was changed again that for the first time in the state's history, landowners are putting additional funds into what's known as special purpose appropriation, or allowing up to $3 million of landowners' funds to be used to augment those local fire districts when we know an event is coming, a lightning storm or something like that. So we, the Department of Forestry, has signed contracts with helicopter, with hand crews, with air tankers, others, that the landowners are paying up to $3 million of those costs, and the general fund is only picking up $2 million of those costs. So we have a $5 million special purpose appropriation in order to get in front of those events when a large fire is coming. We can't predict exactly where they're going to be. We don't know if the lightning is going to hit on Forest Service land or on private land. But we do everything we can so that when the fire starts, our crews are there and can get that them small. And I think the numbers are 93% of the fires in the most recent year are kept at 10 acres or less. That's on the state system, not the federal system. So I would point to, again, the problem is not getting the fires out and getting in front of them by the State Department of Forestry. It's the federal side.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Bill Kluding, Mike Sullivan, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Committee, for the record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters and Joiners of America. This bill was brought out a session or so ago. It's been changed a little bit. I'll be right up front with you. Last time we was neutral on this bill, but a lot of things have happened. You've heard from the experts how this bill's broke down. I won't even go into that, but just in the summary alone, we like to mill logs in Oregon. I've been, three governors ago, I was part of the Federal Forest Advisory Group, and woody biomass, it's been the top of my agenda since that day. There's a credit for that. Fire suppression, it's not if or when, It's just going to be how big the fires are. Nobody knows what the cost is going to be. We continually work watershed enhancement. The way the Clean Air Acts are going, a lot of people are going to have to switch over to the wood stove certification programs. That's in this bill. The chair of committee, I live in Polk County, just across the river. We have no law enforcement from 10 o'clock p.m. until 6 in the morning. Our DA staff has been cut in half. The jail staff is at the federal minimum. We cut out counseling for kids. In this bill, counties will get a certain amount of money. I'd be remiss if I didn't try and get Polk County some extra money. I sit down with my leadership and my members and to discuss this bill. You know, our organization was at the forefront. It took a long fight to where state timber couldn't be exported. We kept our state logs at home. The same fight with the federal timber. Well, we all know the federal timber is almost off the table. But I'll tell you what the turning point was. My boss has asked me, Bill, what's the outlook for the state timber? We got 2,000 members in a very critical area in Southern Oregon. And chair committee, I can tell you, we're hurting. The Elliott Forest is shut down. The North Coast Forest Districts are almost shut down. Appeal after appeal after appeal. My boss has asked me, what's the outlook look like? I says, well, now, let me be clear, chair, committee, this don't fault the Department of Forestry. If they hadn't been doing their job all this time, we wouldn't have a forest to fight over. They try their best to get these sales online. There's certain groups out there that already, I think they've already got the paperwork filled out. All they got to do is stamp it. Hopefully we can convince our attorney general to step forward and start fighting some of these appeals, hopefully. But that was the turning point.
Are you able to wrap up in the next minute or two?
I'm almost done, Thank Chair. You. This is why our organization is endorsing 3481. I don't know what it's going to turn out to be, but if it puts one more log in a mill in Oregon, I guess that's what I'm here for. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart and committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director in Oregon for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. I'm going to make brief remarks because I submitted a written testimony, another document with two links, and one is to the trade adjustment assistance, which will be important in my short presentation. The worst part of my job is to see perfectly good people be displaced from their work that have done nothing wrong. And the paper industry is definitely an environmentally friendly industry, which is now in China. And every mill that's been shut down in Washington or Oregon in the last 10 years has been dismantled and shipped and moved over to China. In the last 15 years, every pulp and paper worker has qualified for trade assistance adjustment assistance in every mill in Washington and in Oregon. Presently, 70% of all recycled, recovered paper is being exported. So with the confluence of export of log and waste paper, there is no stuff, raw stuff, for pulp paper workers to make paper. Waste paper can only be recycled 3 or 4, maybe 5 times before it's dissipated We're hoping that this bill will change the course of the export of these raw materials that we can do, because the United States is, by this industry's definition, is a third world country. We're exporting our natural resources. We would like to see this state export paper products, you know, that are environmentally friendly, made in Oregon, and it's a value-added product. In the end, this is a jobs bill. And as my counterpart, Bill Clooney, wears his jobs lapel, I think he wears it on his chamois at night as well. This is what it is. It's purely a jobs bill for us. And I thank you, and I'll answer any questions that there would be.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it very much today. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3481 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2070. And I know that Commissioner Freeman has come more than 100 miles, and he's sitting in the front very patiently. So why don't you come up, and we may have a couple of other people joining you as soon as I see the list again. Okay. Let's see. What do I got here? Well, why don't you go ahead while I'm studying this list and present your testimony. Thank you very much for coming all the way up from Douglas County to be with us today.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, honorable members of the committee, and Representative Reed. My name is Tim Freeman. I'm a recovering member of the Oregon State Legislature and a Douglas County Commissioner. I appreciate you giving me a little time today to speak about an important issue we got to hear a little bit about earlier. So the conversation regarding the future of gainshare program has created a great strain on the legislature over the past few years. I got to be a part of that just a very few short months ago. The concerns about the program are genuine. Oregon needs to adequately fund schools across the state, ensuring a fair and equitable distribution of resources to every district. Until recently, I had the pleasure of serving as a member of the House, and during that time I raised several concerns about gainshare being fair and equitable distribution for all of our districts. While these concerns remain strong with me today, I find myself asking, where would we be without the program? Oregon's model of economic development comprised both of the Strategic Investment Program, SIP, and gainshare is the single most effective local governments tool local governments have in their disposal to recruit and retain significant employers in their communities. State revenues, the portion that are completely reliant on income tax, are one of the most volatile revenue streams in the country. Revenue for local governments, driven almost entirely by the property tax system, are a disincentive to large businesses. This fundamental weakness jeopardizes the ability to recruit and retain businesses in our communities, and in turn, secure the resources vital for state services such as education and public safety. The SIP was designed to be Oregon's number one economic development tool. Its success has far surpassed our wildest dreams. You earlier heard Speaker Kotek said she was a freshman when this was passed. I was a freshman in 2009, and the program was really just getting its footing, and it has done really amazing things. Local governments employing SIP surrender local property taxes for the purposes of recruiting unprecedented private sector investments, infusing hundreds of billions of dollars into the state's economy. Meanwhile, cities and counties are required to make critical investments in local infrastructure in order to attract these businesses. These investments require significant upfront investment by local governments and carry enormous financial risk. Gainshare serves as the other half of the model by furnishing a financial interest for local governments to take calculated risk in order to successfully recruit these investments. In the absence of gainshare, there is no financial incentive for local governments to utilize the SIP as a mechanism to support job creation. The ability for local governments to negotiate the terms of an agreement allows them to set minimum requirements, such as job creation, retention, in order to achieve the abatement. The answer to my earlier question about where we would be without gainshare is simple. Our state and local governments would not be able to provide the businesses that Oregonians expect. Our statewide school funding would suffer as a result of limited income tax revenues driven by these investments, and local governments would not have the financial stake in job creation. Economic development cannot be a zero-sum game. It cannot happen in a vacuum. In order for economic development to be successful, every single level of government needs to have a stake in the game. There are some who have wrongfully deemed SIP and gainshare conversation as a Washington County issue. This could not be further from the truth. Yes, Washington County has been the major operator of the model and has certainly been the most successful local government using this program. The debate concerns every local government in Oregon and the tool that they have in their toolbox to secure investments in their community. Eliminating or minimizing either part of our economic development formula threatens our ability to create jobs and secure stable funding for our schools. In closing, I would like to make a note that Oregon's model of economic development is twofold. The SIP is the instrument for local governments to recruit private sector investments into their community. Gainshare is the state's lever for encouraging local governments to maximize potential job creation for the SIP. Together, the models create a symbolic partnership between state and local governments to work together in order to recruit the best employers possible. The success of SIP and Gainshare model of economic development testifies for itself. The conversation needs to be about how we can strengthen Oregon's model to produce more private sector investment and produce even greater job creation in every corner of the state, not how we can minimize the success. One other thing I'd like to report to you all, as I'm closing, is there is life after the legislature. Some of you have been here a long time, some of you are fairly new. There's an entire world out there that doesn't have caucus meetings. There's no procedural motions. There's nothing that we call a remonstrance. And the meaning of sine die means absolutely nothing. So with that, I'd like to report that I'm enjoying my new role in government, and I appreciate all the work that you are doing here in Salem.
Thank you very much. Questions for the commissioner? We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for having me.
Very much appreciated. Melissa Unger, Laurie Wimmer, Phil Bentley, please.
It's like a damn rest of the day for right of our way.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. In the state of Oregon, we represent over 55,000 workers who serve many different populations of people in the state, seniors, people with disabilities, people with developmental disabilities, your DMV. You can list it. We serve them. And right now, we represent a lot of members who rely on services, and we're here to support House Bill 2070 because we think it sets a right list of priorities for our state. Today, with a coalition of folks, we just released a report called Invest in Oregon, and it really talks about all these different things that we need to be investing in our state that people care about, whether it's mental health or childcare or schools or seniors. The list is long, and we really believe this bill is about priorities. Without additional resources, we'll be facing a funding gap that will come at the cost of quality care for our most vulnerable. Every family caregiver wants to know that their mother, their father, their child is going to have a quality care, but without additional resources, that will not happen. There'll be real cutbacks that impact people's lives. In addition, with potential caseload growth, we could actually see cutbacks that will cut people off of programs. Right now, there's over 2,000 people on the waiting list for employment-related daycare. Employment-related daycare is a jobs program. It puts people back to work, like it allows people to go back to work and provide for their family. With a waiting list, we're preventing many moms or dads from being able to find safe and reliable daycare, which means that they simply just can't go back to the job that they have found. We hope that we continue this conversation about how we invest in services, whether it's investing in our kids or the most vulnerable. And we really believe that this is the step in the right direction to make sure that we're prioritizing the services that Oregonians rely on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association and its 42,000 members, as well as serving as chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition. And we, too, are here in support of both the underlying bill, House Bill 2070, and the Dash 1 amendments. Either approach would be great. Ever since it was enacted in 1993, as you've heard, the preferential property tax treatment, known as the Strategic Investment Program, has resulted in losses of education sector revenues. This has occurred without the voices of education at the table when counties make this decision to abate property taxes for SIP participants. Under the SIP, the governments, local governments receive some fees in lieu of taxes, but schools have not been formally similarly accommodated. When the Oregon legislature decided to institute gain loss to make counties whole, again, schools were left out. And I've talked to you about this before when I testified on another version of a way to plug the hole that was left for schools earlier this session. When the general fund is used through excise tax treatment, preferential treatment for state-level tax breaks, again, resources are reduced, meaning that the state school fund is less than it otherwise might be. According to the tax expenditure report, in fact, fully $3 billion of economic development tax breaks exist among Oregon's 378 tax expenditures. And, of course, I point out that it takes only a simple majority vote to institute a tax break and a supermajority to delete it. So, again, because of these circumstances, Oregon has, for the last two decades, disinvested in public education year after year for nearly as long as many of us have been around. Reading the headlines, one learns that the result of this is that our classes are nearly the largest in the nation, our school year the shortest, our absentee rates high, and our graduation rates low. This legislature just passed a budget that was characterized as a down payment by us on a no-cuts budget for 15-17, but as a standalone budget, it falls short of fully funding our schools. Whenever a new tax break is added to the list, that makes this situation worse. According to the legislative revenue, every local property tax dollar, speaking of the SIP, any property tax dollar foregone translates to a 33-cent hit to the state general fund because of how the school funding formula spreads these losses. That's why we support the acceleration of gain share sunset as a step to begin to unravel the knot. We would also be happy to take a meaningful step in that direction through the Dash Ones to clarify the original intent of Gainshare, which was to support the creation of new jobs by capturing an increment of the new net jobs created and not all jobs. And so we proposed, as I said, a similar concept in House Bill 2672, which you heard on March 3rd. We have no pride of authorship, however, in which vehicle might move that begins to take a step in the right direction. And we would ask that you support either the underlying bill or the Dash 1 amendments as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bentley.
Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Phil Bentley with the Oregon Healthcare Association. OHCA represents more than 700 long-term care and in-home care agencies throughout the state of Oregon, employing more than 40,000 Oregonians. And I would note that our small business employers do not receive any local property taxes breaks. OHCA supports the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2070, and we appreciate the leadership of Speaker Kotek and Senator Burdick for championing this legislation. The Dash 1 amendments, in our opinion, reforms the gainshare program in a way that is fair and sustainable, but also goes back to the original intent of the legislation that was passed in 2007 and preserves the program going forward for local counties. The tax expenditures through programs such as Gainshare have a direct impact on the resources available to all of you to help fund critical services throughout the state. And we would ask that you view the reforms to the Gainshare program through that lens as issues of budget priorities. Our concern as we look to the 15-17 budget that you all are preparing is that based on what the co-chair's framework has provided, there's already about $140 million hole in the human services program, and we believe that hole could be growing based on caseload projections. Therefore, in order to close out the budget before sine die, you all are going to have to make some very difficult decisions, and the gain share program, I think, is a critical piece of the resources that you're going to have available to you to make those critical, those very difficult decisions. I would just note, for example, that our caregivers are looking for just a basic inflation rate adjustment, and those caregivers provide the care for seniors throughout all of your communities as well as people with disabilities. And so at a time when we have an economy that's growing, we could be cutting some of those programs. And just from an economic development perspective, our providers, when you put dollars into our providers, you bring down $2 of federal match. So for every dollar that's put into a tax expenditure and not spent on a federally matched program, it's actually costing you double. So I just want to present that perspective as you all consider these difficult decisions about how to reform the gainshare program, and thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We very much appreciate it. We'll hear now from Jim McCauley, please. Washington County.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, for the record, Jim McCauley representing Washington County. I think probably the easiest thing for me to focus on as far as some comments for the committee is to kind of get back to the original context and intent of the bill that went through in 2007. That was Senate Bill 954. I think from a contextual standpoint, back in 2007, the employment base at Intel was roughly 15,000. Today, it's closing in on 18,000. I think from a foregone revenue standpoint, in terms of what SIP is for the Washington County, it was around $47 million a year in 2007. Today, it's about $120 million in terms of foregone revenue as a result of the SIP agreements. Similar type of context in terms of where payroll was at that point in time versus payroll at this point in time. I think looking back into 2007, the projections that folks were looking at, it wasn't a mistake whatsoever. It was purely based on the information that was known at the time. People were talking literally about hundreds of jobs, not several thousand jobs. They were also talking about income levels that were in the 50 to 60,000 range, not 170,000. So that's the reason why we're really here today, is because the program, the model, has essentially outperformed what anybody's expectations are. I don't honestly know what this is going to look like in the future. I don't think anybody does at this stage. I think it's important to bring this up is because even though we knew what the projections were in 07, we're in the $4 million range for the first year payment structure, I think equally important to understand is that because we've got such a huge increase, or a much more significant increase in overall population within Intel's operation, but also in the scale of how much is abated, that's the reason why there is a substantial difference between four and a variety of different other choices on how to redistribute gain share funds. I think that's important, again, in the overall context of how you have to take a look at this. And why there's an incentive piece that is still critical for how our county evaluates this. And we've had this opportunity a number of times. I mean, we obviously have done well, and we go through a pretty deliberative process in that as well. And without question, had we been able to put Gainshare into the contract for the new SIP with Intel, we would have done it. I don't know how more clear I can be about what is important and the value that Gainshare provides a local government in terms of an incentive. Lots of conversations take place in front of this committee as far as incentives for one industry or another. There's absolutely no question that SIP is important for Intel and for others, and has the potential to be important for other investments that are active and ongoing right now throughout the state. Equally important to that is the Gainshare piece for the local government to continue to sign these types of agreements, not just today, but long term. Our board, our commission, clearly believes that the Gainshare SIP program is a model. It's a model for economic growth, and we also would oppose any bill or any amendment that goes beyond what we consider to be a reasonable compromise or a reasonable choice to move forward with. I think in general, looking at both the amendment as well as House Bill 2070, I can't really provide any more detail other than to say we oppose it. It's too dramatic of a hit, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? We're out of questions, I guess, for today. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's see, Nancy Matella and David Roth, please. And then my last panel is John Mullen, Marcia Kelly, and John Bartholomew. And if you're able to be brief, that would be very helpful, because I have three more following you.
Chair Barnhart and committee members, I'm Nancy Matella with Tax Fairness Oregon. You can basically tear up the written testimony that was given to you, because I didn't get the amendment ahead of time. My fault. But this way you don't see the typo. So I do have two very important things, though, to say that's still relevant. We were very pleased with what the speaker had to say and Senator Burdick. There's two things, though, that remain. Number one is I live in a county, the 25-plus counties, that don't have a SIP and therefore don't have gain share. I live in Multnomah County. We don't get gain share, and yet Oregon OHSU doesn't pay any taxes. Portland State University, the largest in the state, doesn't pay any property taxes. People like Mercy Corps, who they're housed in a very, very expensive Northwest Portland area. They don't pay property taxes, but Multnomah County doesn't get any gain share. So we feel that there is still an inequity. We understand that SIP is an economic development tool, but education is too. And we are being dinged for our education budget in order to support basically Washington County. The other thing that I wanted to bring forth is one of those charts on your list is relevant. Let's see here.
To what topic?
To gain share. Okay. This is a projection to 2029. I realize now that it's 2025 that you're considering, 10 years rather than 14 years. But it still begs the question of how many dollars do you want to put into this system? Once you decide to do gain share again and extend it, we have no control over how many SIPs will be done. Paul, I apologize to you. We use 6% for the minimum, and I know you said only 3 years. We just extrapolated it out. Those are the little bumps at the bottom that you can hardly see. The large bumps, though, are the miracle of compound interest. We basically saw an increase of 80% year to year to year of the current gain share. Let's say that that got extrapolated, because we don't have any control over what kind of SIPs will come our way, just like we had no idea that the last 3 years would be so successful. You ramp that up, and if it was 2029, you're up to the $3.5 billion per year expenditure. Now, you're going to say, or some people will say,
of course, this is current law that you're talking about.
This is current.
And I would really like to get to the other panel if I could today. Can you wrap it up?
Okay. Basically, we say we have no control over which ones which will take the SIP and therefore which ones take gain share. And it could be billions of dollars. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Benz and members of the committee. I'm David Roth. I'm here representing myself on this occasion. I appreciate the apologetic testimony of the Speaker and Senator Burdick concerning the origins of the gain share program. But I've got some history, more recent history, about the deal between Washington County and Intel that I'd like to share with you. The original deals back in the 90s was set the threshold for tax exemption at $100 million. In 2014, the new agreement used by Washington County and Intel used the same base, $100 million, and extended that base for 30 more years. TFO calculated that the cost of living rose $60 million from the beginning of the Intel SIP to the 2014, and it's reasonable to expect that a parallel increase will occur in the subsequent 30 years. If Washington County is so cavalier about their tax base as to ignore the cost of living increase over half a century, I don't see why the state should compensate them for that loss. The revision that the Speaker recommends could add up to, if I understand correctly, $100 million for Washington County for the next decade, if it's $10 million a year, or if it's $5 million a year, it would be a $50 million cost to the state. As a committee, if you were faced at the end of this session with a surplus of $100 million, or let's say $50, how would you choose to spend it? Would you send it to the O and C counties who are in such desperate need? Would you pay for 5 additional days of school for Oregon's kids? Or would you want to send it to Washington County, which is one of the most prosperous counties in the state? I believe that there are better ways to spend those dollars than to send them to Washington County, and I think if you think about it a while, you'll agree. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Now the last panel that I mentioned earlier. And I think Mr. Bartholomew has left, so it's the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. And yes, my colleague John Bartholomew extends his apologies. He had to leave. The Human Services Coalition is made up of about 80 organizations and individuals. And I just want to touch on a couple of points, and I won't go on for very long because I know you've heard some very good testimony. Mr. Bentley talked about the issue about the co-chair's budget and the gap, and that's very concerning to the Human Services Coalition. We have such issues as we have a crisis in mental health services. I think people are very much aware that there are domestic violence issues, services that are necessary. The Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Program, which we're trying to do a redesign of, you have to be at 37% of the poverty level to even get into the program. And one program that I'm trying to reinstate some services for, general assistance, is services to the poorest of the poor who are unable to work for a year or better. That was eliminated during the last recession. So I think going forward, basically what the Human Services Coalition of Oregon really wants to do every time we have an opportunity to talk about this is that we are very concerned about the final deliberations around the budget and the fact that we have such an enormous gap to fill, not only in the co-chair's budget, but also the issues that are stacked as far as needs that where programs and services have been cut over the years. But I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Sometime I'm not going to be the last one testifying, so I'm hurrying. We are in favor of the original bill and consider the amendments by the speaker as a vast improvement. We didn't have a real long time to read the bill, but if I read it right, it does also seem to say that you can't double dip with jobs related to the industrial site readiness program. And if Paul would have done an explanation, I might know that for sure, but I'm hoping that that's the case, because double dipping in my estimation is not a good thing. So that might be a real improvement. The $10 million cap, again, seems very good, especially because of the state school fund. I appreciate the speaker from Washington County being concerned about changes and the ability to keep Intel because of the deferral of property taxes. And I have a new and improved spreadsheet to provide for you after I give my testimony. You take a look at it, you can see what the property tax loss will be, and you can see the property tax shift to other taxpayers, and that wasn't clear when I first did that. But I would contend that one of the real reasons that Intel is so happy to be in Oregon is the single sales factor, has nothing to do with the SIP, has everything to do about the way that they pay corporate taxes in the state of Oregon. That does mean that manufacturers who don't have high sales in Oregon are happy to stay in Oregon. And I think that the history, since the SIP has been in since 1993, I believe, and it's still only being in Washington County and in wind farms in smaller counties, means that either other people are not using it, or it's been limited in its application because of other considerations. And other considerations might mean be the ability of people to get trained workers and the ability of people to move to this state and know that they can educate their kids and that there's a safety net available for other folks.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? We appreciate your testimony very much. I'm looking forward to your schedule when we get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2070. Colleagues, we're going to carry over House Bill 2361 to Monday. There obviously being no time to consider it today. And I appreciate very much your patience and your attention. And with that, the committee is adjourned.